This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So the quicker we respond and reach, also get to people to talk to them about how to protect themselves, how to prevent infection, how to deal with infected family members or loved ones, the better it is for any future control. So the earlier we get to any places where this outbreak could possibly reach, the better.
That's World Health Organization spokesman Christian Lindemeyer on efforts to stop the spread of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Details coming up.
Also, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and President Donald Trump agreed to move forward on a joint project to build the Nairobi-Mombasa Expressway. And South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar and other opposition leaders have refused to sign the latest draft of a revitalized 2015 peace deal.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has been in Washington over the past few days. He met yesterday with President Donald Trump in the White House, where they agreed to move forward on a joint project to build the Nairobi-Mombasa Expressway. They also plan to elevate the U.S.-Kenya relationship to a strategic partnership with annual dialogue on promoting mutual prosperity. While in Washington, Kenyatta sat down with VOA's Esther Gitui Ewart for an exclusive interview about a broad range of subjects, including his campaign against corruption at home. Today, we bring you part two of that interview.
Mr. President, now let's go back to Kenya and your efforts to fight corruption in the country. Do you feel confident that you're going to win this war?
I believe we're going to win this war. There is tremendous commitment, I think, now from the agencies that have been involved in this work. In that end also, we appreciate especially the support that we've gotten from the United States in terms both of capacity building and training and involvement of their officers from the FBI to other agencies who we've been working closely together with. And we believe now we have an institutional framework that will be able to deliver strong results. The political commitment is there. The will of the people of Kenya is committed to see an end to corruption. And I believe that this time we shall succeed in our endeavors.
Now moving on to the regional issues. We've seen South Sudan ink deals about peace in that country, which never took place. Now they just inked another deal. Do you feel confident that this time round there will be peace in South Sudan and that President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar will hold the country together?
It is impossible for me to say that I believe it will or it will not. But what I can say is that we are committed to working together with our regional brothers and sisters to ensure that peace and stability returns to South Sudan. And we must, therefore, put our hope and faith and continue to put pressure on the leadership of South Sudan from all sides, that it is their ultimate responsibility to ensure they come together and find a framework that works to restore peace and stability and ultimately human dignity to the people of South Sudan.
Mr. President, we have a new Prime Minister in Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, and he has made quite some sweeping changes in the country, trying to bring the country together, opening democratic space in that country. You've met with Prime Minister Abiy. What does he expect from regional leaders like you?
I think what he expects is our support, and I have committed to give Kenya's total support. I believe that he has a vision for his country and he has a vision for our region as well. And I intend to work very closely with him to establish that. We are very happy with the situation as we see it, the rapprochement now between Ethiopia and Eritrea. All this works for peace in our region. All this works for stability in our region. And for us to be able, as a region, to focus not on insecurity or wars, but rather to focus on economic growth and prosperity of our people, job creation for our people, and to focus on the positives, as always, instead of always being identified as a region of crisis. And I look forward to working together with Abe as a partner to be able to achieve that objective. I wish him well. And I continue to say I am strongly in support of what he's doing, together with his other colleagues in Ethiopia, to help achieve this dream for us all.
That was Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta speaking with VOA's Esther Gitui Ewart.
South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar and the leaders of other opposition parties have refused to sign the latest draft of a revitalized 2015 peace deal. The SPLM in opposition and the South Sudan Opposition Alliance say one of the most contentious issues between the warring parties, the number of states and their boundaries, has yet to be agreed upon. The deal leaves it up to regional bloc IGAD to determine the number of states and the boundaries. Michael Atit has this report from Khartoum.
Despite the SPLM, IO and other opposition parties' refusal to sign, delegates of the Kiir administration and other parties did sign the latest agreement in Khartoum. Speaking at the signing ceremony this morning, Sudanese Foreign Minister Al-Dirudiri Mohamed Ahmed says mediators engage all parties, all of whom did reach agreement on several other issues.
We agreed on the issue of the five ministries that are supposed to be created anew, as we have enlarged the cabinet of South Sudan from 30 to 35. Additionally, we have agreed on the sharing of powers and competencies within the presidency. Now we have a clear line of demarcation for all of the powers and authorities that shall be shared among the five vice presidents.
Ahmed admits that mediating the talks for the last 2 months has not been easy, given the contentious issues including Article 4, which deals with number of states and their borders. Lama Kol, head of the National Democratic Movement, a member of the opposition alliance, says since the warring parties have not agreed on the number of states and their borders, he sees no point in signing an incomplete deal. Akol says his group asked the mediators to include arguments and suggestions that Article 4 be annexed to the final document of the peace agreement and sent to IGAD. That way, he says, the opposition would be guaranteed that IGAD would resolve the number of states and their borders.
This summary was necessary to harmonize the two provisions under the same article. That is the main concern of that summary. Second, it also outlines some guidelines for the IBC, the committee which is entrusted with deciding on the number and boundaries of the states.
Akol says even though the mediators had promised to annex a document containing arguments and suggestions regarding how to resolve the issues, opposition delegates were surprised to learn today the annexed document was not attached to the final document that was distributed for signature. Parties also did not agree on the criteria for selecting ministries during the transitional period. In addition, the warring parties did not agree on what constitute a two-third majority during the Council of Ministers meeting or during voting in the National Assembly during the transitional period. SPLM-IO delegate Stephen Jalpal says his group insisted that the signed document should include suggestions on how to resolve the dispute over the number of states and their boundaries, which he says would provide a clear choice for the citizens should an independent boundaries commission fail to resolve the issue.
We should not just go with the 32 states as they are. And we need to have it as a multiple choice of 32, 10, and 21 states. And we want to start with the demarcation process because, you know, the 32 state arrangements that was, you know, arbitrarily decreed by president, has also annexed some lands of some other communities to other communities.
Both Akol and Pal assure the South Sudanese people that the opposition will work with the mediators and the government to bring lasting peace to South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
The World Health Organization reports the next 7 to 10 days are critical in controlling the spread of the Ebola virus in eastern DRC. In its latest update, the WHO reports 111 cases of Ebola, with 83 confirmed and 28 probable, including 75 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports it is continuing to rapidly scale up its response to the Ebola outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri provinces, including in Oicha, a town difficult to reach because of security concerns. More than 100 armed groups are operating in these areas, putting some places known as red zones off limits because of the dangers. But WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer tells VOA health workers have had access to all places they need to go with the help of MONUSCO, UN peacekeepers acting as escorts.
We, as you also know, between Beni and Oicha, there is a red zone. Oicha itself is not a red zone. But also there, getting to Oicha is possible with the help of MINUSCA, and we're very thankful for that.
Oicha is believed to be surrounded by Ugandan Islamist militias who are blamed for a series of killings and abductions. Lindemeyer says the next 7 to 10 days are critical in efforts to prevent Ebola from spreading to areas that cannot be reached.
So the quicker we respond and reach also get to people to talk to them about how to protect themselves, how to prevent infection, how to deal with infected family members or loved ones, the better it is for any future control. So the earlier we get to any places where this outbreak could possibly reach, the better.
The World Health Organization reports 4,130 people have been vaccinated against Ebola, including 726 healthcare or frontline workers and more than 900 children. It notes more than 7,000 additional doses of vaccine have been transported to Beni, and more doses are en route to DRC from the United States. The WHO says 17 patients have been treated with 2 experimental drugs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
17 past the hour. You were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. A Nigerian news company released an alleged proof of life audio recording Monday night of Leah Sharibu, one of the so-called Dapchi girls abducted in February by Boko Haram militants. Sharibu is among more than 100 female students taken hostage by the Islamists in the northeastern Nigerian town of Dapchi. Insurgents released other classmates but continued to hold Sharibu captive, reportedly because she refused to convert from Christianity to Islam. Leah's parents and activists have stepped up calls for government action to free her. Chika Adua reports from Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria.
The parents of Leah Sharibu, a Nigerian high school student kidnapped by Boko Haram in February, have since then had no idea if their daughter was still alive. But now, they may have finally heard her voice. I am Leah Sharibu, the voice says. I was kidnapped from Dapchi school, and I am begging the Nigerian government to have pity on me, it says. The audio, along with a photo of Sharibu in captivity, were released on Monday night by Nigerian online news outlet The Cable. Nathaniel Sharibu, Leah's father, says the voice is indeed his daughter's.
Yes, it's her. She is the one. Yes, I feel very, very encouraged yesterday as I hear her voice. I believe now that my daughter is still alive.
In the 35-second audio clip, the voice, alleged to be Sharibu, asks for the Nigerian government to help her family. They have been having a hard time in the months since Boko Haram abducted her, along with over 100 of her classmates. While the insurgents released her classmates, Sharibu remains in captivity, reportedly because she refused to convert to Islam. The Free Leah Sharibu hashtag and the audio recording have been trending on Nigeria's social media. Nigerian activist Rebecca Gadzama says the proof of life audio is an answered prayer.
I knew it will come up one day. I had the confidence in me that the government wants it to bring this girl back. So I've all along been positive.
The Nigerian government did not immediately confirm the audio's authenticity. A spokesman for President Muhammadu Buhari said they were investigating the audio and would soon release a statement. The Bring Back Our Girls movement, which launched after Boko Haram's 2014 abduction of the Chibok schoolgirls, vowed to increase pressure on the government to free Sharibu.
Why I say they need to see video is for us to at least we can see her condition. We want to see video and clear terms of her rescue. What do they want to release her? So they should tell us exactly what they want in exchange for Leah. Is it money? Is it their fighters that were arrested in the past? Or what exactly do they want? If the government is serious, they can bring all these abducted people in the next 24 hours.
The Nigerian government was heavily criticized for the time it took to free most of the 276 schoolgirls Boko Haram took from Chibok. 89 were released last year in a government swap for Boko Haram prisoners, but more than 100 are still missing and believed to be in captivity. Rights groups say Boko Haram has abducted at least 2,000 children since 2009, when it began fighting for an Islamist state. Chika Odua for VOA News, Maiduguri.
Tensions are mounting among militias affiliated with Fayez al-Sarraj, the head of the Presidency Council of the Government of National Accord. Yesterday, two groups, the Tripoli Revolutionaries and al-Nawasi Battalions, attacked the positions of another armed group, the 7th Infantry Brigade, in the capital. The brigade vowed to protect its position and the capital against the other militias, which it accused of serving external agendas and of peddling narcotics in Tripoli. Some experts on the region see the confrontation among these militias, which are affiliated with the defense ministry, as a threat to Libya's fragile stability. Isando El Amrani is the director of the North Africa program of the International Crisis Group. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawy about the challenge of militias in Libya.
What you have is some of the smaller militias, often from outside Tripoli, who are resentful of the domination of the capital by four main militias that have a stranglehold on state institutions. And, you know, this speaks to the incapacity of either the Libyan government or indeed the international community to really address the insecurity in Tripoli and the lack of broader security arrangements in Libya. Today, you have a problem that's increasingly coming to the fore of militias seeking to hold state institutions that control, especially that control the oil money in Libya, hostage and essentially securing payoffs in exchange for allowing these people to operate safely. And that has to stop. It's not clear that the Libyan government has any resources at its disposal other than, you know, paying off those who come for financial compensation, others may come.
The Presidency Council attaches special importance to supporting two of the four militias, al-Nawasi and the Special Deterrence Force, which are both deployed in the area surrounding the naval base where the Presidency Council has its headquarters. Would that mean GNA will back these militias against the Tarhuna's 7th Infantry Brigade?
A group like the Special Deterrence Force, which is not only in control of part of the area around where the Libyan government is headquartered, but also the remaining international airport in Tripoli, the area around the central bank of Libya, wields enormous power because of the areas that it controls in Tripoli. And this is causing a lot of resentment among other groups. Some of those are the other groups in Tripoli, but also the forces elsewhere in the country, whether it's in the east and the forces in General Haftar or other cities like Misrata in the west, that are unhappy at what they see as the domination of these key state institutions by a few armed groups.
Would that confrontation raise again the issue of disarming Libya's militias and form a united armed force?
Of course, and this question has been for really since the 2011 revolution, a key one. I think part of the problem is that over the last few years, part of the price of getting the government of national accord headed by Prime Minister Sarraj in place in Tripoli was making a deal with these militias. But, you know, over time, at that time, that may have been necessary to secure a safe entry into Tripoli. What it's all defied into now is a situation where these militias have disproportionate power, that have a stranglehold on government, and you know, whether real or apparent, and it's causing tremendous resentment elsewhere in the country. It's a theme that, for instance, in the east of the country, General Haftar, opponent, if you want, of the current arrangement in Tripoli, continually raises in his public speeches, and a lot of Libyans are starting to feel the same way, that a few groups that are well-placed have a stranglehold over the economic lifeline of the country, especially when you look at the financial institutions like the central bank or the National Oil Corporation.
That was Isander El Amrani of International Crisis Group. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
Uganda's former Inspector General of Police has been released on bail after 76 days in military custody on charges of failure to protect war materials and aiding and abetting kidnapping. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala. Analysts say the case points to a political power struggle in the East African country.
A military court in Kampala has granted bail for Uganda's former police chief, General Kale Kihura, who has been in military detention for about 2.5 months. Kihura is charged with allowing arms and ammunition issued to police units to be given to gangs and paramilitary organizations, and with kidnapping for his involvement in the forced illegal repatriation of Rwandan exiles and refugees to Rwanda. Kihura faces a maximum penalty of death if convicted. In seeking bail, Kaihura's lawyers argued the 62-year-old is not well and requires medical attention outside Uganda. Analysts say, as police inspector general, Kihura worked more to suppress political opposition and protect the power of President Yoweri Museveni rather than actual policing. But political analyst Patrick Wakida argues because Kihura is a military official, his alleged quest for power was misconstrued as resistance to the government from within the army, which led to his persecution and prosecution.
And what lies underneath these cases that they are put on him is a power struggle. And I can tell you that power struggle will continue. Even those who are actually prosecuting him are asking themselves, what comes next to us? Does it only prove what everybody says, that there is only one emperor in this country? The rest are servants of that emperor.
One of Kihura's lawyers, Jet Tumwebaze, says his arrest and continued detention by the army is an injustice. He adds any actual lawbreakers are still in the ranks.
You can see they promised to charge General Kare with 19 counts, and the other day they only could manage a miserable 3. Which are also service offences. If I am the head and my lieutenants abuse their firearms, go for them. So if any officer working under General Kare kidnapped or misused the gun, please, the guys are still within the confines of this republic. Let the law take its course.
Kihura must remain in Kampala and Wakiso and may not leave Uganda without permission of the military court and army leadership. Halima Athmani, VOA News, Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, pressure mounts on Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni over the beating and detention of music star Bobi Wine. And we'll discuss the legacy of Kofi Annan, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.